Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Parisa Nesva Durrani, Chair of the Club's Middle East Forum, and your chair for today. We also welcome our listeners on radio and invite you to visit us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, the Ambassador of the Arab Republic of Egypt to the United States, Nabil Fahmy. Ambassador Nabil Fahmy is a career diplomat who has played an active role in numerous efforts to bring peace to the Middle East. He is internationally recognized for his expertise in the field of disarmament and international security. Ambassador Fahmy has held many appointed positions, including Egypt's ambassador to Japan, political advisor to the foreign minister, and member of the Egyptian mission to the United Nations Disarmament and Political Affairs in Geneva and New York. Ambassador Fahmy's expertise has led him to participate in numerous Egyptian delegations, few of which were chairman of the UN Secretary General's Advisory Board regarding disarmament matters, leading the Egyptian delegation for the Middle East Peace Process Steering Committee, and the Egyptian delegation to the Multilateral Working Group on Regional Security and Arms Control. Ambassador Fahmy received his Bachelor of Science in Physics and Mathematics, as well as Master of Art in Management from American University in Cairo. He speaks English, French, and Arabic. Married, has two daughters and a son. He is a New York-born American, and we welcome him home. Please welcome Ambassador Nabil Fahmy.
Thank you very much for that kind introduction. I want to thank the Commonwealth Club for allowing me to come to speak to you this afternoon. As you all know, I was a bit late. That was basically to warm you up and get you used to Middle Eastern talk, which I will engage in. And it relates more to my Egyptian heritage than my place of birth, which is America. I'm not an American by nationality, but I was born here, and I'm quite happy to have been born here. I want to address, and I will try to be concise, one issue this afternoon. I will use that to talk about some regional issues, but if I skip on a topic of interest to you, please feel free to raise it in the question and answer session. The issue that I want to raise is the importance of the Egyptian-American relationship and explain to you why I think it has been important and why I think it will be important in years to come. I raise this because living in America before 9/11 has been different from living in America post 9/11. 9/11 was a traumatic experience for America. It had not been attacked on the continent since World War II. And it was attacked in a manner that it had never witnessed in the past. And those who attacked you came from the Middle East. Consequently, your posture vis-a-vis the Middle East shifted, and given that we are a very prominent member of the Middle East, you looked at us either for help or trying to find answers to the question or as a target for blame for what happened to you. And it's been different living here since then. But I want to explain how it's been different, why it's important to look at this relationship in a larger context. First thing is, let's look at the balance sheet carefully. Any relationship, any project, has its good and its bad points. But if you look at the three or four major issues that have been of interest to America in the Middle East region in the last 25 years, and look at where Egypt was and what role it played on all of those issues. One, the Arab-Israeli conflict or the Arab-Israeli peace process. Frankly, when we started the peace process, you were nowhere to be seen. You didn't think it was possible. You were still engulfed, understandably, with the bipolar world, with the Soviet Union. That was your priority. when Anwar Sadat tried to start the peace process even before the 1973 war. Ultimately, he took further steps, and you came on board in this, and Jimmy Carter was able to bring together Anwar Sadat and Menachem Begin to Camp David to bring closure to the first ever peace agreement between Israelis and Arabs. Every single agreement that came afterwards between Israelis and Arabs, Jordan and Israel, the Palestinians and Israel, the disengagement agreements between Syria and Israel were all based on the Egyptian-Israeli experience. So if it's only for the Middle East peace process, your interest in promoting peace in the Middle East, because it serves your interest nationally, globally, excuse me, or because that's the way you found it best to support your friends in Israel and your friends in the Arab world. If Egypt had not been there, there wouldn't have been a peace process. And it's been the only player that has consistently tried to promote Arab-Israeli peace in good times and bad. When people lost hope in the peace process, the Egyptians continued to try to move that forward. In the last 6 months, where you've seen a change in political power among the Palestinians and a change ongoing today of political power in the leadership in Israel, Egypt has been the interlocutor between the two sides, and I commit to you, we will continue to play that role in the months to come because it serves Egypt's national interest. Other issue is your relationship with Iraq, or if I can redefine that, your relationship with Saddam Hussein. In the first Iraq war, when he invaded Kuwait, and consequently in the second Iraq war on the issue of weapons of mass destruction, Egypt joined the coalition fighting with American soldiers against Iraq to liberate Kuwait in the 90s. We did that because for us, any occupation is a violation of the law, and it's something you need to stand up with. And we did that because there was an international mandate from the UN to do that. So when we agreed with you, we fought with you shoulder to shoulder. In your second relationship with Saddam Hussein, when the context was weapons of mass destruction, we did not agree with you. Not because we supported Saddam Hussein, but because as a medium-sized country, we need to have authorization from the Security Council before the use of force is applied, except if there's a clear expression of aggression. We need that as a medium-sized country because that's our security safety net. But even though we differed with you on how the war started, nevertheless, you flew over Egypt in going to your Gulf bases as you operated the war. Nevertheless, you traveled through the Suez Canal in going down to that area. And since the war has ended, we have been trying to work with you very constructively in trying to develop a new paradigm in Iraq, which will take time, by the way, so that it becomes a stable force in the region. We will be working with you in the months and I fear to say years to come to ensure that Iraq is a sovereign state for all Iraq. It's unified and inclusive for all of its ethnic communities. We think preserving Iraqi sovereignty over traditional Iraq is important. We think dividing the country up on an ethnic basis would be wrong, and therefore we will work with the Iraqis and with you to ensure that they have a strong government and a strong constitution that is a pull factor to the different communities to retain their Iraqi identity as paramount in their relationships. So I gave the Iraq example because it's an example where when we agreed, we put our soldiers in harm's way, right, exact same way you did. And when we disagreed, we didn't stand against you. We did not worked at your detriment. And frankly, once our differences were overcome or that phase passed, we are still working in the same towards the same objective. I'll skip one issue, the issue of terrorism. Egypt was attacked by terrorists, the same terrorists attacked you before you were. We've been at the forefront of dealing with this issue for many, many years, and it is a political and socio-economic issue as well as a criminal issue. Or let me rephrase that. It's a criminal issue as well as a political and socio-economic issue. And since you were attacked, we have been in close cooperation with you in trying to solve all the elements of that problem by cooperating with between our different security forces, cooperating between our different legal establishments, because it is primarily a criminal issue. But it is also a political and socioeconomic issue because you need to dry up the support for terrorism, or at least to dampen the apathy that people may have in terms of why they don't confront terrorism. So on the issue of terrorism, again, there hasn't been a partner that is stronger than Egypt in terms of the relationship with the U.S. In terms of the modernity of the Middle East, you have very strong security interests in the Middle East, and you have very strong energy interests in the Middle East. Because you are a global power, all projects aside, you will continue to be dependent on Middle Eastern, you will continue to have security interests in the Middle East as your vessels go from the Mediterranean into the oceans, and vice versa, as you try to deal with your different economic interests around the world. You will be posturing in and around the Middle East. And frankly, we live right in the middle of it. So one way or the other, if you're going to operate in the Middle East, you will be engaging Egypt one way or the other. The other issue is, of course, also the energy. Energy conservation aside, and to have a more conservative, I don't know the best way to describe it, energy policy is probably healthy for America, so it's a good idea. But realistically, we're talking about a time away before you will not be dependent on significant Middle Eastern oil, if ever. So you want to know where the region is going. Is it going to be more modern, more conservative, more liberal? One out of every four Middle Easterners is an Egyptian. We're 76 million Egyptians, and there are about 280, 290 million Middle Easterners today. So what we do, for better or for worse, will have an effect on the political trends throughout the Middle East. It will have an effect on how Middle Easterners look at you, how they cooperate with you, whether they're frustrated or fulfilled. So you will be bumping into either Egyptians as you operate in the Middle East, or virtually by way of our thought process and how it influences the Middle East in years to come. And we have a vested interest, and I want to say, in all of those four issues that I mentioned. 56% of the Egyptian population is 25 years or younger. I need to create jobs for those youngsters. I need to create a modern Egypt for those youngsters. So pursuing modernity and a centrist policy in the Middle East is our national interest, and we will be pursuing that in years to come. And I can't do it. I can't engage the international community strategically or economically without having a strong Egyptian-American relationship. So even if we were to differ with you, we will still have a keen interest in having a solid, positive relationship with the U.S., at least for a generation to come, only for our direct economic needs. Let me also deal with, we cannot deal with the issue of terrorism. And I repeat, we were targeted first. Without having international support for this quest, in the early 80s, in the mid-80s, we suggested holding an international conference on terrorism. And we did that because we suffered from the fact that people thought that if it didn't hit them, they weren't part of the solution. So money was flowing in and across the banking system worldwide, coming into Egypt, financing terrorism, and we couldn't get control on it. People were telling us, well, that's your problem, and these are private, issues of privacy here, and we can't engage you on these issues. Terrorists, including Middle Eastern terrorists, were training in Afghanistan, networking in Europe, and operating in Egypt. The terrorists who attacked you trained in Afghanistan, networked in Europe, and attacked you. When they attacked you, you were able to put together international consensus, international coalition to try to find a common work plan on issues of security, a common work plan on issues of money laundering, a common work plan on not giving safe haven to terrorists. These are all things that we will continue to be interested in and we will need your support on the Middle East peace process. We're 85% there, but the last 15% is the most difficult part. And I'm talking about the Palestinian-Israeli issue in particular. We need to come to closure on the issue of Jerusalem, where it's a capital of two states that is open and undivided for both, but it's a capital for a Palestinian state as well as an Israeli state. We need to come to issue and resolve the issue of the refugees, where most of them will go back to the newly established Palestinian state, and some will go back on the basis of humanitarian concerns to Israel proper. That has to be done by mutual agreement. It's not going to be forced by one side on the other. This has to be a negotiated agreement between both sides. If it's not, it will continue to be a thorn in the back of Middle Easterners, of Arabs, Israelis, and frankly, America, given its interest in the Middle East. And we will need, of course, to find a solution to the security concerns of Israelis and Palestinians, ensuring that the Palestinians live have a strong security system. At the same time, a security system that is not a surprise threat potential to Israel per se. I need to do this as an Egyptian because, frankly, to be able to get Egyptians to think about the future rather than about the past, thinking about building and having hope in the future rather than whether or not somebody has been wronged in the past, will not work unless we can put to rest the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. And I can't, frankly, market the region economically if people say, well, what happens if there's another Arab-Israeli war, even though the reality is Egypt has not been at war with Israel for 30 years now. And I don't envisage a war occurring where we would be. But large investors will not come in if they feel the risk potential in the region is too high. The uniqueness of the Egyptian-American relationship, and I will conclude with that point and then give you more time to ask questions, is nobody else can build the bridge between the Middle East and the Western world except us. Ultimately, this bridge is going to be an Egyptian-American bridge. Either we build it or it will not be built. If Egypt has to lead the way in the Middle East to create a Middle East that feels confident that change, that becoming part of the international community, that engaging the world is not at the expense of its own heritage. It's not at the expense of our own identity. That living in a global society does not mean we are less Egyptian or less Saudi Arabian or, for that matter, less Israeli. That actually engaging in a global society allows us to put on that agenda our own concerns, our own priorities, and remaining isolated from that engagement is what ultimately create a source of friction. The opposite is, and I say we have to do it, frankly, because, well, we have the longest heritage in the region, we have the most experience in the region, and we have the most cosmopolitan society in the region. So if we're going to stand up and say we're the leader of the region, I say very candidly, I think we are, but I also say very candidly, we need to engage in that task, which is a serious challenge for the future. The same applies to the U.S. You like to describe yourself as a superpower. I don't think that's true anymore. I look at the U.S. and I see a global power in front of me, not a superpower. I see the reason I make the distinction is a superpower, in my mind at least, focuses or relates more to your physical power or your military power vis-a-vis some other adversary. And I don't see an equivalent adversary outside there in the global community. I see many, many different challenges that you may face, but none of them that would threaten your dominance or your prominence in the near term. So you will not be able to energize your own community to put substantial resources against one target, because the target isn't there. That's a large enough threat to generate a strong American support against one issue. What you need to do to truly exercise the power of America militarily, economically, by way of technology and creativity, is to ensure that your people understand that you are the global power domestically. You're the most global of all nations of the world because you have so many different constituencies among yourselves. And you're also the most global among all the countries of the world because you have economic interests in Thailand, you have economic interests in South Africa, in Egypt, in Colombia, in Chile. You have security interests in all of those continents. What happens anywhere around the world provides you with an opportunity that you can take advantage of much quicker than I can as a medium-sized country. And it also has implications on what you do or what you don't do economically and politically in a negative sense if you don't react to it properly much more quickly than it would on Egypt in the immediate term, because I don't have the range or the scope of activities and interest that you do. The reason that this has become so important now rather than where it was 5, 10, 15 years ago is in a global society, we live in an open, transparent fishbowl. And with the power of communications, what happens anywhere around the world is immediately generated into our living rooms and bedrooms, into our political systems, in a split second, for that matter. America cannot lead if it doesn't carry that moral responsibility around the world. And frankly, Egypt cannot continue to claim leadership in the Middle East if it doesn't carry that moral responsibility in our region. So I'm going to close with saying I personally think that the Egyptian-American relationship, if taken over a period of time, the balance sheet is overwhelmingly positive. And where we may differ, I find that healthy because we are actually different, both in terms of our size, our culture, our heritage. And I think if we were, if we did not differ, there would it would not be an open, candid relationship. I think at the same time that both of our roles are indispensable, that one of the challenges that we face today is what is the relationship between the West and the Middle East? Some people like to describe it as the West and the Islamic world, but I don't. I look at it more as the West and the Middle East, and you are the leader of the West, and we are the leader of the Middle East, so we have to carry that that responsibility. And I want to say here quite openly, I'm confident that if we are able to generate in our own constituencies, respectfully, each one of us, if we generate a wider understanding of globalism, of our responsibilities as leaders in international community, we will be able to carry that mantle and be able to create those bridges. If we don't, if we focus on parochial politics, which are with pressure of time and immediate issues, we will have failed in that in the challenge, and ultimately we will pay consequences of our failures. I am essentially confident that things will move forward. I know that there is a strong engagement between our leadership, positive and negative. We have a very candid and open relationship, and I, in my contacts with both sides, I know there's a commitment to reinvest the relationship for the mutual benefit of the two sides, and for that matter, for the mutual benefit of the world at large. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to Nabil Fahmy, Ambassador of the Arab Republic of Egypt to the United States, for his comments here today. I'm Skip Rhodes, past president of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, and I will be moderating today's audience question period. Mr. Ambassador, we have a large number of audience questions, so let's begin. One that's in the news here in the United States for the last couple of days and still there today. What is your opinion of the proposal to take over the running of six major U.S. seaports by a United Arab Emirates company? Does the concern expressed by critics constitute prejudice on their part?
Well, that's sort of a very wide brush. Let me say, for the record, I don't think you should make a determination on the validity of a business transaction based on nationality, be it Arab or non-Arab. If that was the case, then other countries shouldn't do business with multinationals, most of them that are Western-owned. And you would be basically breaking down the whole logic and concept of the World Trade Organization. Same criteria should apply to any business venture, and I don't think you should determine the value or the validity of a project on its ownership. I'm not actually sure how much of that is purely owned by one government, but irrespective of who it is. So I differ with those who object. I think the administration's position on this is valid, but I'm not going to describe the motivation behind the objections.
Mr. Ambassador, how well do you believe the U.S. is handling the war on terrorism? Do you believe Arabs and Arab Americans in the U.S. are being mistreated in any way?
Well, there are two questions there. I think the war on terrorism needs a focus. You need to refocus that war. And you need to, if you want, separate it from other issues in order to ensure that you have the widest possible support for it internationally. In terms of treatment of Arabs in America and Muslims in America, post 9/11 it was very difficult. But the treatment has gotten much, much better since then. We get very few serious complaints from our Egyptian-American community, but we have some. There are still some prejudices that occur, but I want to say for the record, they're decreasing. And the more you become, to go back to my first point, you become cognizant of the fact that you are a global community, that these Arabs or these Italians or these Greeks are actually these Americans at the same time, because that's how America was established. The more you realize that an Arab being in a global community, an Arab living in America, isn't really that much different from an Arab living in the Arab world. And that's where we're going by way of globalization. So, yes, there are still some problems, but they're decreasing, and I appreciate the effort to make sure that they end completely.
We have a number of questions on Iran, so let's start with the first one. Is there any realistic diplomatic solution to the nuclear weapons issue with Iran?
Yes. Is that enough? I think it's a two-part solution. One is to convince Iran to not want to pursue a nuclear program that raises concerns for others. I mean, Iran, even if it remains within its own rights as an NPT member, and much of what it's doing actually is within Iran's rights as an NPT, as a non-proliferation treaty member, some of the programs still raise concerns with some countries because there hasn't been full transparency on programs in the past. So the first part of the answer is, I think the pursuit of the European proposal with the Russian package is a good start to solving the problem. However, that's not enough for us. You need to respond to the security dimension as well by creating in the Middle East a zone free of all of nuclear weapons of any respect, be that with Iran or, for that matter, ultimately in Israel's hand, applying the same standards for everybody. So I would use a two-tier approach. One, deal with the immediate problem, but also package it with a longer-term program to deal with the root causes of this whole problem.
Follow-up question, do you fear that we are getting closer to a military solution as the only answer?
I would hope not. I think the longer you don't solve the problem, the more probable that diplomatic solutions will not be sufficient. But I don't really think that a military solution solves the problem. So I don't see them as either or. We believe that the diplomatic solution is the better way to go. But you need to make it a more robust and a more strategic diplomatic solution by problem management, which is what we're doing now with problem solving, which is to establish a zone free of these weapons, which is transparent, verifiable by all regionally and internationally.
This questioner makes a statement and then asks a question. The U.S. is quite concerned about Iran's recent statements and its pursuit of nuclear status. Where does Egypt stand on Iran?
Well, Iran is a very important nation in the Middle East. They have a long heritage, and they will have influence in the region for generations to come. Where we would like to see their policies can be summarized in that we think they should support the Arab-Israeli peace process. We think that they should desist from any programs that might be in the pursuit of nuclear weapons. And we think that they should try to truly invest the rich heritage that they have towards building a modern Middle East. That's really where we stand on Iran, and we are very straightforward and candid with our Iranian colleagues. At the same time, to be very honest with you, when we differ with them, at the same time, we cannot ignore that they are a very significant people in our region.
Moving next to subject of Israel, what percentage of Egyptians agree with the current president of Iran's view on Israel?
I'm a physics math major, and I couldn't put a figure to that. It's simply so minimal. We have a peace agreement with Israel. We're trying to build a peaceful modern Middle East. We're not revisiting history. We're not challenging history. We don't agree with the statements made.
How does Egypt view the current American and Israeli sentiment concerning Hamas, given it was, in fact, a democratically elected government?
Well, I'm happy to comment about Egypt's opinions on Hamas rather than America's and Israel's interests. But anyway, to answer the question, whatever government had, whatever party had been reelected or elected in the Palestinian elections, we would have asked them to abide by the same three principles. One, to try to pursue a negotiated settlement in the Middle East. Two, to commit themselves to respect the obligations taken by the previous Palestinian government. And three, to pursue the peace process through negotiations, not through the use of violence. Hamas has been elected democratically in a free, fair election. There's been no question about that. And once the government is established, we will ask them to respect the same three parameters. Let me also say, once the Israeli government is reestablished after their elections, we will ask them to continue the peace process based, again, on the obligations taken by both sides in the past. So But let me just simply add also another point. We think it's important to understand that this is about the Palestinian people and the Israeli people. It's not about one party or the other. So you need to have a strategic outlook in answering the questions and the challenges and not be reactive to immediate steps.
Is Egypt under any U.S. pressure to favor Israel in this situation?
No. The only dialogue we have with our American friends is about how to continue to build on the peace process, and that's a pile-on dialogue. We pile on a little bit, and they pile on a little bit. We're not working against each other here. It's completely consistent. And there's a tremendous discourse between us. Today, Dr. Rice is in Egypt, in Cairo. She met with the foreign minister, the prime minister, and our head of security, and she meets President Mubarak tomorrow morning. So this is an issue where there's no daylight between us in terms of where we want to go. There may be differences in terms of tactics, but it's not. We're not working at cross purposes here.
Please give us your opinion on what Israel and the U.S. should be doing regarding the Hamas request for continued financial support. What is the likely impact to be with the decisions each will make?
Well, as the Palestinian government is reestablished, and as long as it's in fulfillment of its obligations past taken, then, frankly, Israel has to continue to fulfill its obligations past taken as well. And one of them is to hand over the tax returns. The taxes that Israel collects, customs, are taken on trade operations in and out of the Palestinian territories. They're part of the past Oslo process. So as long as the two sides respect that, the Israelis have no right to withhold that money. The American situation is a bit different. They've taken a position vis-a-vis Hamas as a political party and determine whether or not they want to give that assistance. There's no legal obligation on the part of America to give assistance. So it's different from where the Israeli obligation is. But we think that the Palestinian people should not be sanctioned for making a choice. We think that they should be convinced, the Palestinian government should be convinced to respect the obligations taken by previous Palestinian governments to engage in the peace process and not resort to violence.
Next question, what do you see as Ariel Sharon's legacy for Israel and the Middle East? Will he have created any lasting possibilities for peace?
10 years from now, I'll give you an answer to that. And I say this respectfully. I cannot judge somebody based on my mindset today and on today's events. I don't know how things will work out. We will judge Israeli leaders, Prime Minister Sharon, and Arab leaders, including my president as well, in the context of history, on whether they took the right decisions or not, when the time they took them, not on how they turned out per se. I think Sharon made an important diversion from his previous posture of keeping as much land as he could to wanting to withdraw from Gaza, and some of the West Bank. Whether that was only to satisfy Israel's security needs or as part of a strong peace process, regrettably, one can't make that determination because he is ill and it's not foreseen that he will resume office. But I need more time, really, to make a judgment on political leaders.
For our radio audience, I would like to remind you that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California's radio program, and our speaker today is Nabil Fahmy, ambassador of the Arab Republic of Egypt to the United States, who is discussing the challenges and possibilities for Middle East peace. Our next question, please comment on the Islamic cartoon uprisings. Is this emblematic of a greater problem than just the cartoons?
Yes and no. I think it is problematic, and it is a bit larger than the cartoons itself. And the problem is we are not yet used to living in a global environment. We're not yet truly appreciative of the influence of the media and how quick it transmits information from one area or the other. That being said, let's deal with the issue itself. The cartoons, by any standard, were offensive to Muslims. You can argue that, well, freedom of speech means good stuff and offensive stuff, and I don't question that. I don't think that if you use the right of freedom of speech offensively, you're doing the right thing. So, and I don't think that if you use it irresponsibly, it should be without consequence. What is the situation if you stand up in a crowded movie theater and scream fire, and you have a stampede out of the movie theater? Is it an issue of freedom of speech? Is it being irresponsible? Do you focus on the people who started the stampede out of the movie theater or on the person who screamed fire? I don't support, let me rephrase that, excuse me. I completely understand demonstrations that occurred in the Muslim world, but I don't support the use of violence against anybody or anything, even by way of expressing anger. But I think it's important for us to preserve a balance between freedom of speech and being responsible. And I don't mean that we will live in a world where nothing that is intolerant will be published. But I think what I'm meaning is when that happens, governments have to take a position that this was wrong, even if they do not prevent it from happening in the future.
Many people view the problem of fundamentalists resorting to terrorism as a reaction to sudden and forced modernization. If so, and even if not, how could Iraq learn from Egypt's experience in the process of change and modernization?
Well, I've always shied away from trying to apply one model to the other. Egypt, for example, doesn't have the same ethnic diversity as Iraq does, so we don't have the same kind of problems per se, and I'm not sure our model would apply there. But you learn from some of the experiences. The reality is openness or democratization is a cultural transformation, and it's a learning experience. You went through this over a 200-year period, and you're still questioning yourself. I don't think that the American democratic system is ideal, but I think the genius of it and the strength of it is you continuously want to make it better. You continuously challenge yourselves to try to make it better. I would tell my Iraqi colleagues, well, you need to put together a system that is an inclusive pull system inwards rather than one that is so decentralized that it pulls the ethnic communities away from each other. And I would tell them that it's the learning experience. We have moved substantially forward, but we're not where we want to be on the issue of reform. Even in Egypt, we will see more progress and more mistakes in Egypt as we try and move this process forward. So they have to go through their own experiences. And I would urge our Western friends to give it time. It's going to take time for us to go through those processes. And we will have to put together our own checks and balances, our own paradigms, our own limitations on the process. But I'm not embarrassed to say you shouldn't shy away from trying to encourage communities to be open, but allow them to do that. Don't try to force it upon them.
When you talk about a modern Egypt, how do you envision the cultural blend between Egypt and Western principles such as the division of church and state, freedom of speech, or transparent political systems?
Well, I don't really see a separation of church and state in the way that you have it here, where you can't have prayer in a public school. I don't see us going to that extreme. At the same time, I think there's no inconsistency in ensuring that everybody has the right to fully exercise and express his own faith on an equal basis. While one faith can be dominant by way of majority, it should not impinge on the rights of others to exercise their own faith. The other two points were what, excuse me?
The freedom of speech and transparent political systems.
Sure. Freedom of speech. If you read the Egyptian press today, we have everything there from a very distinguished, serious, self-censored journalism to yellow journalism at the same time. Ragtag, anything you want is out there if you can just find a story to write. We have to find our own balance. Freedom of speech, the only constraint that I would apply, that I would want our society to apply on freedom of speech, is to be tolerant. I can't force people to be correct all the time. I can't force them to embrace our position. So I don't see any real problem between your application of freedom of speech and where we should be. And the third point was what?
Third point was the transparency.
Transparency.
Political parties.
Sure, we're moving there very quickly. But it's a learning experience by way of operation. Let me explain why. We had a presidential campaign with 10 candidates. We have 21 political parties in Egypt today. The election, however, was not really competitive. It was free, it was fair, it was democratic, but given that one party was so much stronger than the others historically, and given that the president is an incumbent president with a very strong record, clearly he won by a very large majority. In the parliamentary elections, we had 6,000 seats, 6,000 candidates for 444 seats. We had violence in 20 to 25 voting stations. We actually had 25,000 voting stations. So while it's regrettable and we need to solve this problem, it doesn't reflect on the whole process. There were good and bad experiences in our evolution in this area, but the governmental process in Egypt today is becoming much more transparent, much more responsive to our community, and I see that moving more and more because we are moving from a centralized system to one that will be more decentralized and hand over more authority to the cabinet, to parliament, to municipalities. That empowerment of the people is what will make the government process more transparent in the future.
President Mubarak has just delayed Egyptian local government elections by 2 years. Please comment on this action and what it bodes for democratic reform in Egypt.
I understand the perception that people have about that, that postponing election presumes that there's some sort of Machiavellian desire to not allow the people to express their opinion. The reality is we have put forward a program, or the government has put forward a program, the president, that he intends to submit to parliament at least 5 substantial laws, one of them rebalancing the powers of the president and that of the parliament and the cabinet in their favor, revoking the emergency law, submitting a law that would ensure further independence of the legal system in Egypt, another law on party participation to encourage party participation, a law on gender issues, and a law on decentralizing government, including decentralizing government in favor of the municipalities. The logic behind the postponement was we want to elect people to govern the municipalities, so let's submit the amendment to the Constitution that requires giving the municipalities more power and then have the elections after that to this new post. I understand the perception that, well, this is a desire to put off democracy, but I don't think that's the case at all. I actually think it's a function of a serious attempt to change the foundation of how we're governed, and it just takes some time.
Could you tell us what the agenda is of the Muslim Brotherhood Party in Egypt?
I'm not a member. I don't think they know. I think they have some basic principles that govern how they think. I think they envisage establishing in Egypt a state that's consistent with a conservative interpretation of Islam for the more conservative members of the party. I think others are much more liberal, who are members of the party, but are much more liberal, more engaged. And I'm serious when I said I don't know, because I think their position will crystallize and shift as they become more active parliamentary members. And you will see them either being able to garner support among a larger number of Egyptians, which will mean they will move towards the center if they decide to not be malleable in their posture and stick to absolute positions, they will lose support in politics.
Your thoughts on this question, Mr. Ambassador. Will democracy in the Mideast lead to radical Islam taking control of the area?
If we have a democratic evolutionary process, no. I completely share the opinion that people are born to be free, that they have the right to be empowered in their own government, that they should call for transparent government and accountable government. If that's what you mean by democracy, no. I think there's no question that we need to do more in that respect, and that we are going to do more in that respect. If you don't understand the reality on the ground, if you don't build the institutions of democracy, you don't teach people how to act in democratic society. Democracy is not about holding an election. It's not about simply the majority winning. It's about the majority winning and respecting the rights of the minority. It's about a minority losing and expecting that the majority wins and that they're part of the system. We need to develop that. That takes time. You went through a long process to do that, and you had your own experiences. As I may have mentioned a few minutes ago, you had to deal with the issue of segregation. We don't have an issue of segregation, but we do have a long heritage of centralized government, and we need to relieve ourselves of that heritage. So people question authority in a positive sense, and the authorities accept the question in a constructive manner. So I don't see democracy in the Middle East leading necessarily to extremists taking power, but I think it is naive to think that this is going to work overnight.
Have there been any changes in U.S.-Egyptian relationships since President Bush was elected?
Not as a function of President Bush per se, but yes, as a function of 9/11, which, of course, happened very soon after President Bush was elected. So, and President Bush has said that his perspective on foreign policy has changed after 9/11. 9/11 was a traumatic experience for all Americans. And your concern pointed towards the Middle East. If I'm going to claim to be a major player in the Middle East, I cannot deny the fact that you will also look at me. I think it's the result of that concern is a greater re-engagement. You're actually more interested in what's happening in Egypt today, wanting us to do more rather than moving away from Egyptian-American relations. So I think the Egyptian-American relations are solid. They're actually more intensive. They're more engaged. And because of that, because we're closer, each one of us has to understand the other system better. And when we don't, you see the points of friction. But overall, the relationship has proven its mettle in a very difficult 6 years post 9/11. It's not a function of President Bush.
A follow-up question. Is there anything that can be done to strengthen U.S.-Egypt relationships under the current administration?
Well, again, I don't want to tie it to the administration. I was not trying to be rhetorical or simply use platitudes when I said that I truly believe that America and Egypt have a special responsibility in building a bridge between the Middle East and the West in the years to come. To do that, I was sincere in saying Our first target has to be our own communities. Americans have to understand that they are the global power. It doesn't mean only responding to the world when you're threatened. It doesn't mean only looking for the maximum short-term benefit. It means looking at the world as your marketplace, your environment, understanding it, investing in it long-term, without there being that counterpart that you're so worried about. And you need to develop that yourselves. I can't do that for you. I go around America arguing that case, but ultimately you have to do that. And back home, Egyptians and the Egyptian government has to plant the seeds of confidence that change is not a threat, that change does not go against our traditions, that we can embrace change and lead the region forward and still be truly Egyptian, but a different kind of Egyptian. That's really where I think our roles should be in the years to come, and that's the challenge that we face.
Is tourism a major factor in the cultural openness of Egypt as different from other less visited Arab countries? And I did say tourism, okay?
Thank you for that clarification. Yes, it is. It's also the fact that we're, frankly, geographically situated in the middle of the region. Historically, every other traveler has either traveled through Egypt or occupied Egypt for a couple of years or been thrown out of Egypt after a couple of years. So we have a heritage of engaging the world. Now it's in tourism. I mean, now it's not about arguing. And 15% of our GDP comes from tourism. I've been discussing with the administration for a long number of months, and they, frankly, are receptive. The best way to invest in the future is exchange programs. In Egypt, we financed our own money, no U.S. aid. Our own money, we financed the establishment of an American studies program at Cairo University to put to the average Egyptian a full-fledged study program about America, not about today's events, about who you are. And we didn't ask you for the money because this was done for our interest. I need Egyptians to understand what America is all about. We didn't do it at the American University in Cairo. We took it to a public Egyptian university. You need to do the same. You need to understand the world. You cannot risk not understanding the world. You will miss out on an opportunity if you do not understand what's happening around you. So we need to just keep pushing that we live in a different environment today, and we, each one of us, holds a special responsibility in that regard.
A follow-up question. Would you say that travel to Egypt is reasonably safe nowadays for Americans at this time?
Oh, yes. I have no doubt in my mind that it's safe. Tourism is actually up about 20% over last year. The number of American tourists is not that high, but everywhere else around the world is quite common. I don't know of any American friends who have gone down to Egypt and have felt any inconveniences that are directed at them in any way. So I'd encourage you wholeheartedly to visit, and I'm have no problem with the issue of security per se.
Mr. Ambassador, unfortunately, we've reached that point in our program where we have time for just one last question, and that is, and you've covered this in a number of other questions, but this is asked in a little different tone. The President of the United States says democracy is the Middle East event which will help protect us from terrorism. But almost every recent election in the region has led to a rise of Islamic and fundamental organizations that are hostile to the U.S. Would you comment, please?
Well, to have, let me again say, democracy is not about holding an election. Election is an expression, a process, part of putting together a system where you have accountable, transparent checks and balances in society as a whole. You need to build the institutions first. An election is a competition. It doesn't mean you have all the components out there engaging. If you hold an election between parties that existed in a non-democratic situation. They will win the election. You need to get the people out to participate in this new environment and then hold an election. I encourage you to help institution building in the Middle East. I encourage you to help in capacity building in the Middle East. And underline again, I'm saying help. Don't do it. Help them do it. They have to train judges, train journalists. What they write about you is their opinion. But just train them so that they can write better. Train the judges and provide facilities to put legal systems there that they will apply by their standards, but they will apply them better. At the end of the day, the institutions of the American system are what will lead to more positive results than you will get if you simply decide, well, okay, can we monitor that there is a free and fair election, but we have not yet energized society to engage in an election. Let me give you one point to explain this a bit more clearly. I think that our elections, we just had the presidential elections and the parliamentary elections, were a very significant step forward. But the point where we succeeded the least was the one that's least dealt with in the West. Our greatest failure was that 23% only of the population participated in the vote. That's the challenge. Where are the others? How do we get the others to participate? It's normal, frankly, because in past elections that were less open, we had even less. And you're not going to move from one where you had 10, 15% to 40% in one jump leap of faith. People have to see the process work to believe it. What's happening in Egypt is not a revolution. It's an evolution. And that's why you will see Egypt continuing in the centrist mode. We don't want it to swing to the far left or the far right. So my very long answer to your question is democracy, a success of a democracy, and I don't disagree with your president that that would be highly beneficial to the U.S. in the future, is in getting people to actually engage in the process, as many as you can, and allow their best judgment to determine what policies they pursue. You may not like the result, but you won't get a continuous extremist trend for any long period of time if you have a truly vibrant, engaging political system. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to Nabil Fahmy, Ambassador of the Arab Republic of Egypt to the United States, for his comments today. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.